This is Above Average Intelligence, a production of the DSR Network. Each week, hosts Mark Polymeropoulos and David Rothkopf are joined by leading experts from the intelligence community for expert analysis on the biggest security challenges around the world.
Welcome to the podcast. I'm Mark Polymeropoulos, and this is DSR's Above Average Intelligence Show. Today, I am very happy. Actually, I'm thrilled and honored to welcome as my guest Amy Zegart, someone who I've wanted to talk to, meet, kind of geek out on Intel stuff for a long time. She is the Morris Arnold and Nona Jean Cox Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution and Professor of Political Science at Stanford. She's the author of 5 books specializing in U.S. intelligence, emerging technologies and national security, grand strategy, global political risk management. And her most recent book, which we'll certainly get into, is the bestseller Spies, Lies, and Algorithms, The History and Future of American Intelligence. It's a heck of a book. I think I've given it away so many times. I was running around because I read it and then I gave it away and I can't find a copy of it. So I got to get another one. And I will say it's almost the Bible of the IC for 2024 and beyond. And so, Amy, it is a delight to have you here today. I wish we had more than 40 minutes, but this can be kind of part one of many times you come on the show. Welcome.
Well, thank you so much, Mark. It's an honor for me to be here with you. And boy, I feel like we should just stop the podcast right now because you said so many nice things about me. I want to go home.
One of the funny things is I was a practitioner of intelligence for a long time, obviously. And then, you come into this weird state or, role I have in kind of in the media, but so I was out on the tip of the spear and I didn't really have a chance to meet in person, folks like yourself in academia, real experts. But I will say, I'm going to embarrass you a little bit. I mean, you are incredibly respected within the IC, and I always joke that some individuals, authors, academics have almost a cult following amongst agency officers, and that is you, and that probably horrifies you. But ultimately, it's fun in my role now because I get to meet people I couldn't talk to you before when I was a case officer running around the Middle East, and now I can. So this is great.
Well, I will just say back at you because my information is only as good, or my analysis is only as good as the information I get. And so to have formers like you actually lifting the veil on what it's like to be a case officer, what life is like inside the agency, how it really works, is crucial for outsiders like me.
So, and of course, the key things that I talk about, if you've listened to me or heard the show, or God forbid you follow my Twitter account, which, I've managed to, I tweet about, heavy metal music and the Red Sox, some Intel foreign policy stuff, but my favorite dive bar on the planet, which is the Vienna Inn, which is an old agency hangout. So anytime you come back to the East Coast, we will take you for chili cheese dogs at the Vienna Inn. And I'm sure some of my former colleagues, would love to talk to, and kind of discuss something that we're going to really spend some time on today is where we go in 2024 with the IC. And what we usually do is we start with current topics. And when you and I were talking before, you mentioned something which just occurred, which was the annual threat assessment, the ATA, which and you had mentioned how important you thought that was, and I agree. Actually, it's something that I will tell you that the intelligence community takes seriously when they prepare. And of course, I recall it was actually, they didn't do it under the Trump administration in the last, is it year or two?
Yeah.
Just because I guess people were scared of what kind of controversial assessment they would make and the administration might get upset, but ultimately it's out there and I don't know how many people actually pay attention to it. And so can you comment on that? What happened in this year's briefing with Avril Haines and Bill Burns, and really the substance of it, is the IC getting it right?
Yeah. So, Mark, I'm so glad you mentioned it. It is that the annual threat assessment is the most important intelligence event that nobody pays attention to. So this is a golden opportunity for Americans to see what our senior intelligence officials think, how they reason through things, how they're perceiving the world for the next year. These threat assessments have been public, at least by my count, for 30 years now, and they're incredibly revealing. So in the 1990s, I actually looked this up. From 1994 to 2001, the annual threat assessment mentioned terrorism every single year. and mentioned terrorism for 3 years before 9/11 in the top tier of threats facing the nation. So the argument that the IC had no idea what was happening was just empirically wrong. So I think these threat assessments are crucially important. This year, I'm a nerd, so I actually looked up how many people watched on C-SPAN the hearings. 9,000 people in the United States.
That's not a lot.
It's not a lot, right? How many more have been watching March Madness? Orders of magnitude more. So I think it's a real missed opportunity. In terms of what they said, it won't be surprising to people who follow intelligence closely. Like D.N.I. Haynes talked about three major categories of threats: great power competition, the movie we have seen before. The second is transnational bads, right? So she lumped in technology, illicit drugs, terrorism in that second category. And then the third category was regional conflicts that have cascade potential. So you think naturally about Ukraine and Israel. So that's pretty standard, but I think there's some hidden nuggets in this threat assessment. So I'll share with you my sort of four hidden nuggets in the threat assessment. Number one, technology. Of course, I'm focused on emerging tech. The word superpower was used only one time in the 40-page assessment, and it was used with respect to China and technology. Hmm. And so the threat assessment talks about how China seeks to become a world S&T, so science and technology, superpower, and to use that status for economic, political, and military gain. Wow, right? That's the headline, right? So that's sort of hidden nugget number one. Hidden nugget number two, be careful about election interference in 2024 with Russia, China, and Iran. So it's kind of buried or peppered throughout that report, and it looks pretty bad when you put those pieces together. Number three, Russian nukes, right? Concerns about the Vladimir Putin's interest in actually using a tactical nuclear weapon. And oh, by the way, he's making more of them. And then hidden nugget number four, space is getting real. Counter space capabilities. This assessment said the quiet part out loud about what China is doing, has already done, what Russia is doing, has already done. And it's getting bad in space. I think most Americans don't realize how contested space is and how concerned our policymakers are about it.
You know, when you kind of go over the threat assessments, and I actually remember, you know, when I retired over the last couple of years before, you know, people took this really seriously. You know, the directors, sweet. I mean, they would kind of bury themselves for days before in preparing for this because it was so important. And of course, just to one mention for the listeners, there's also a classified version of this. So, you know, there's the unclassified hearings, and then they'll go talk to the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence and the Senate as well. So that's you know, really important. But you hear this and you think about the responsibility of an administration. I kind of talk in the media a lot, and you know, I'll give the current administration a hard time on things. But I will say that, you know, if you get up in the morning, you're president of the United States and you receive the president's daily brief, or if you're Jake Sullivan, the national security advisor, there's a hell of a lot of challenges out there, and getting this right is hard. And by the way, none of these are easy. You know, if you look at the conflict in the Middle East right now and you know, Israel's, the Israel, you know, Hamas war, incredibly complicated, you know, but so is Russia, Ukraine. And so there's a lot on people's plate. One just note on that. I mean, you know, one of the things I was thinking about as I was up at 3:50 a.m. this morning, about to go on Morning Joe, talking about terrorism, is that I have spent more time in the last several months talking about, you know, the Hamas attacks on October 7th and then what happened in Moscow, or as much time really as talking about great power competition. So every time we kind of want to shift, and you know, the whole U.S. government aircraft carrier is shifting, you know, east towards Asia, towards the conflict with or pending conflict with China. You know, terrorism in the Middle East or South Asia can kind of suck you back in, and so really are huge challenges. One thing that I want to talk about is something that you have written about, you've spoken about, you're a leader on, is that the notion of emerging technology, and I think it's really important. You know, there's the phrase, I heard it several years ago, the democratization of data, this explosion of technology. And so, you know, these unprecedented challenges of so many technologies changing so much, so fast, so much of it outside of government. It, you know, for me as a case officer, that kind of scares me, or a former case officer, you know, okay, how do I, just the basic notion of how do I jump on the street and do a surveillance detection route to an agent meeting? But talk a little bit about this, about the challenges of emerging technology, and you know, and I'll give a plug. This is, of course, in Amy's book as well. So I would encourage people to give it a read. It's fantastic. But emerging technology, Amy, your thoughts?
Yeah. So I think, you know, this ties to what you just said, Mark, which is that we keep getting drawn into these conflicts, whether it's terrorism, war in the Middle East, or conflict in Europe. We keep getting drawn into these current issues, and emerging technology doesn't feel like it may be the most important issue, but it is. And it is the strategic issue that's going to determine who's going to win and who's going to lose and who's going to lead the world order over the next generation. Right. And so we think about this moment, you know, every generation of foreign policy leaders says they face unprecedented challenges, but this time it's actually really true. So in addition to the, you know, the list of challenges that you laid out, we have this unprecedented rise, this convergence of technology. So it's not just internet connectivity, 2/3 of the world online. It's not just AI, which everyone's concerned about. It's not just commercial satellites, right? Elon Musk is single-handedly deciding where his satellite communications can be used on the battlefield in Ukraine, which side gets to use them and when. One person elected by nobody, right? It's not just quantum computing. It's not just synthetic biology. It's all of this stuff happening at the same time. And so what that means for intelligence is, I think, five things. And I call them the five mores. More threats, right? So technology is supercharging threats, right? Same thing about cyber threats. More speed at which intelligence has to move. More data that is available, which is overwhelming analysts with information. More customers who need intelligence. So voters and people who don't have security clearances now need intelligence in order to advance national interest. It's not just people with clearances who work in SCIFs all day. And more competitors. Anybody with a cell phone can collect, analyze, and disseminate intelligence today. That's good news and bad news for our intelligence agencies.
You know, and when, you know, when I first read this in your book, and then when I was reviewing it again, just, you know, in preparation for the show, I was thinking about, and again, I come back to the practitioner part of it. And so, you know, think about in the past where I would run a surveillance detection route. I determine based on literally, you know, taking turns, you know, left and right, or being on foot somewhere. You know, I would determine no one followed me. I would conduct an agent meeting, collect intelligence, do a return surveillance detection route, and go home and, you know, pour myself a glass of Jameson and think, you know, I just saved the world because whatever I collected is going to go in the PDB. But here's where what you're saying, I think, really matters, because with this, you know, explosion of sensors, for example. So now, you know, matter of fact, that you have biometrics, you have smart cities, your phone is a GPS, your car is, people have cell phones everywhere. So at the end of the day, if you do an operation like I just talked about, you actually don't know what has been collected. And if it was collected, just with this, you know, with the explosion of data, can be retained. Years later, someone could piece together a surveillance detection route I did. And then with artificial intelligence, maybe it doesn't take years later. Maybe it takes a couple seconds. And so the whole, what you're talking about with these emerging technologies, I think has affected the job of human intelligence collection. You know, we call it the ubiquitous technical surveillance environment. But, you know, so what you're talking about in the big picture is really important. But also just for the practitioners on the ground, it's pretty scary. I think we have to kind of change the way we think about operations as well.
And I'd be curious to know what you think about that, Mark, because Director Burns, of course, it was one of the earliest things he talked about was the need for that, you know, human to change based on ubiquitous technical surveillance. But we haven't had any public details about what those changes are. Or what might be a way around them. I don't know if you have any thoughts.
Well, because you can't tell anyone what we're going to do. I think that, you know, that would give away the some secrets. But if you think about it, you almost have to maybe hide in plain sight more. You know, we call in pattern operations. So instead of doing that surveillance detection route, maybe you're doing things that you would do every day. But you're right. This is and Burns has actually, thank goodness, or I'd get in trouble now. He's talked about the creation of a ubiquitous technical surveillance, a UTS center. So I think that's really important. I got to switch one thing. We talked just before, and this is now kind of stuck in my mind. I know you're a college basketball fan, and we talk about baseball a lot on this program. The terrible joke that I've been making, well, that I made, but it's called college basketball, is nothing's funny. No jokes about what happened in Moscow, the terrorist attacks. But when you talk about ISIS-K, one of the things I noted on air, I think, was that ISIS was the one seed if you have a March Madness prediction. I got a whole bunch of crap for that. So I can't make those comparisons anymore. I can't call them the LA Dodgers, or maybe I'll go to baseball. But when you think about, go back to your basketball kind of analogy.
You can pick the one seed that you hate the most.
Right. I don't know. Can UConn be like the ISIS of basketball? Like, I'm going to get in so much trouble. I'm going to get canceled now for this. This is serious stuff. But okay, let's go back to, but in terms of March Madness and prediction, you had mentioned something earlier about, predicting basketball, the March Madness tournament, and then intelligence analysis. So tell us a little bit about that. I love this. This is going
to
be great.
So, I'm glad that we're upgrading from baseball to basketball. So as a Kentucky girl, I'm born and bred a basketball fan. So I think actually basketball gives you a window into problems of intelligence analysis. So why are we surprised that there are Cinderella teams in March Madness? And we love Cinderella teams, but we think that intelligence somehow should be able to predict everything. Basketball is so much easier to predict than geopolitics. Data is readily available, right? It's the same rules. It's the same game played by the same number of people every year for decades, right? Intelligence doesn't have that kind of repetitive data. Our analytic biases, we wear literally on our t-shirts. Right? Everyone knows, right? I'm going to root for Stanford, and I think they're going to win it all, right? Every year, even if the data suggests otherwise. So I wear my
analytics. You're biased, right?
Because I'm biased, but I wear those biases literally on my body. So everyone knows what they are. That's not true in intelligence. In basketball, you know when a win is a win. You don't know that in the real world, right? What's an intelligence success? What's an intelligence failure? Who's going to win the war in Ukraine? We don't know when a win is a win. If you don't know when a win is a win, how do you learn how to do your analysis better the next time? And then, of course, there's not a lot of, with the exception of maybe some coaches, not a lot of deception, right, in terms of coaching a basketball, right? You're just playing the other team. Maybe, a coach here and there is going to hold a little something, something back for the Final Four. But like my favorite women's coach, Tara Vanderveer, go Stanford, just won a tough game last night. She's playing the best game she can. She's coaching the best game every game. She's not trying to deceive the other side about who she's going to sub in or who. We know she's going to start Cameron Brink, right? That's not a surprise. So I think for all those reasons, basketball is so much easier to analyze than geopolitics. But people somehow have these unrealistic expectations that intelligence should be foolproof and predict the future.
Well, what an interesting topic, because, I lived in an organization where we were criticized a lot for intelligence failures. But some of it was warranted. I mean, there are some things that we did miss. But I think you make a good point. And what I've tried to certainly emphasize is that, what intelligence analysis should do. I actually started off as an analyst for 2 years, and I went to the operations side for the next 24. But, predictive is a word to use. But I also think that it would be better if we just kind of put scenarios in front of policymakers. This could happen. And I think we might be better off. Everyone wants to, always wants an answer. Who's going to win in Russia and Ukraine? But perhaps the better question is, if Russia wins, it's a terrible term, but, what happens there? Or if Ukraine prevails? And then you kind of set scenarios up for policymakers. But the idea of kind of predicting the future, I think, is pretty hard. And you're right. I mean, how many people's brackets actually come out in March Madness and they actually win money, win their office pool? I don't know. I'm going to flip back a little bit now, back to the emerging technology piece, because there's something you're involved with called the Stanford Emerging Technology Review. In particular, how the IC needs help, with kind of understanding emerging technologies and how universities can assist as well. Talk a little bit about that. What are you doing with this new project?
So this project started because, Senator Mark Warner, chairman of the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, came to Stanford. It's like about a year and a half ago. And he said, I want to know what you all are doing and thinking about emerging technologies. You decide what they are, AI, synthetic biology. So we pulled together people from across campus to brief him. And it was fantastic. And we realized in that moment, it was not enough, that the model for policymakers in particular to learn about these fast moving technologies is reactive. It's, oh my God, there's this thing called ChatGPT. What do we do about it? Right? It's episodic. And it's based really on the networks they have in Washington, which for the most part are not engineering leaders in these fields. And we need to change all three parts of that process. So this Stanford Emerging Tech Review is the first ever collaboration between the School of Engineering at Stanford and the Hoover Institution. So in each of these 10 critical emerging technology areas, they're the usual suspects, you won't be surprised, semiconductors, space, synthetic bio, et cetera, AI. We have leading faculty members in those areas helping us to develop reports and products and briefings and things for policymakers and, oh, by the way, the IC, to understand more continuously what's happening in these technological areas. And so this was an experiment we started last year. We had overwhelming response from our faculty across campus, which was great. And we released our first report and briefed it across the IC and to policymakers in the executive and legislative branches. And the idea is that universities should be able to play a much bigger role in helping policymakers and intelligence officials understand blue, right? Intelligence about us. So, you know, we're very good at being able to do net assessments. What do the bad guys have in terms of numbers of tanks, numbers of airplanes, right? The Pentagon has a shop that does that. There's no place in the US government that does tech net assessment. Where is China ahead? Where is the US ahead? Where are we behind? Where does it matter? As you know, Mark, intelligence agencies can't do that. They can't collect on Americans. But universities are very well positioned to provide that unclassified intelligence about what are the latest technological developments in these areas that have enormous geopolitical implications. And we should and can do more.
No, I think that's outstanding. And I would hope that, you know, there is going to be public releases of this as well. So the U.S. public can see this. You know, one of the things that I found amusing to me, is that after going to undergraduate and grad school, I remember doing my master's thesis at Cornell University and citing a whole bunch of different professors, all of whom in their various writings had a lot of nasty things to say about CIA. And then when I got to CIA, they were all consulting with CIA. So I thought that was quite, but you know, I mean, these are patriotic Americans who wanted to help. They don't have to agree with U.S. policy, but I think you're right that, you know, that kind of partnership with the U.S. government is absolutely, absolutely critical. And so I look forward to seeing more from that Stanford study. Again, I think that the not only is it important for how you're helping the intelligence community, but also educating the American public too. These, you know, when you talk about some of these issues, they actually are kind of, it's hard, it's scary. It's hard to put your kind of finger around a world that is changing faster. And so just jumping in on that, one of the subjects I love asking guests about is artificial intelligence, but more importantly, tying it to the upcoming 2024 elections. Think about things such as deep fakes, generative AI. We had our old chief of Russia House on, Pat Weninger, last week, and he's working on a project. He's retired, but he's working on a project on this now. He is fearful of what could happen in terms of a political campaign in the future, where there's deep fakes, there's AI that's used. It goes, you know, into the ecosystem, and then what? What are your thoughts on this? Is this something that kind of keeps you up at night as well?
It does. It does keep me up at night. I think we're in the Deception Olympics, right? We're in the early stages of the Deception Olympics. You know, we've seen cheap fakes before, you know, the videos of Nancy Pelosi appearing seemingly drunk when, of course, she wasn't. But now, you know, we've already seen examples of deep fake audio that convinces people that, you know, their grandchild is in jail and they need to, you know, post bail or you know, variety of scams. Scams are usually the early adopters, right, of these new technologies. And so, you know, the incentives are there, the capabilities are there, and it's not just foreign-led deepfakes. You can see domestic campaigns, right, that have an incentive. And if you look at OpenAI, right, which created ChatGPT, so now you have the potential for really handcrafted messages to potential voters, either to stay home or vote a certain way. OpenAI has listed a whole bunch of principles for people who use their large language model. What happens if you violate those principles? You go to OpenAI jail? Nothing. Nothing happens to you. And so that's part of the problem, is there are no penalties for engaging in this kind of very few penalties, right, for engaging in this kind of deception.
So how do you, so what happens? How do we counteract this? You know, it's going to happen. So first of all, it's going to happen. And so, you know, do we as a society, does the U.S. government, does the private sector have a way of alerting people in time? And again, it could be something that's generated within the United States or from our adversaries. But again, you know, I would think that you need almost a war room, 24/7 war room mentality. So how do we do that?
I think you can see sort of the beginnings of the capability to warn the American people. You've seen this with election interference notifications by CISA and NSA and the FBI together. They've done that over the past few years. Not enough people have been paying attention, but we have the rudimentary capability and the competence to be able to do that. So I think you're going to see the IC drawn more into debunking these kinds of deep fakes in near real time. They're going to have to be able to do that. We also need to see legislation so that, you know, you have to, when you're a politician and you have your ad, you have to say, I approve this message. It needs to be very clear. Either it's illegal to use AI generated content, or you have to acknowledge that you used AI generated content. So truth in advertising would help a little bit on that. And then I also think we're obviously going to need to use to get the help of social media companies and the mainstream media to push the pause button when some of these things happen. Because what we've seen with other kinds of influence operations, which you know better than I do, is it's when the mainstream media comments on it, it goes even more viral. And so we have unintended consequences. So you know, the pushing the pause button or getting behind the we're not so sure this is real or not, and making that the headline as opposed to falling victim to the deep fake is going to be crucially important. So the media's involvement is going to be very important in this equation as well.
I agree. And again, this is something that I think that should cause us a lot of concern. You know, there's probably not been a time where I have been so worried about a presidential election. Ordinarily, frankly, someone in the intelligence community doesn't care. You know, I work for four different presidents, and I would always joke that, you know, we had no idea. And you know, intelligence officers are generally cranky at anyone who's in the White House, because we just want, you know, whoever it is to say yes. And you can have intelligence practitioners, or you can have, I'm sorry, presidents who really appreciate the value of intelligence. I mean, you know, whether you like George W. Bush or not, he read the PDB every day. And whether you like Clinton or not, he didn't. And if you remember, there's the famous story, there was a small plane that crashed on the front lawn of the White House. And the joke was that was then CIA Director Jim Woolsey trying to see Clinton, who just never wanted to see him. So, but I think, you know, what we're talking about now is something that should concern a lot of Americans. Let me just kind of course, we've made a plug for your current book, Spies, Lies, and Algorithms. Again, a bestseller. It's considered the Bible amongst, you know, this within the IC, and certainly in a forum, in a town, in a space in which we really are trying to find what are the challenges for 2024 and beyond. So the book is awesome, but I think you have something else in the hopper too. You have a new book on power. Tell us about what you're working on. I don't know how you followed this up. But I think it's going to certainly be highly anticipated. But what are you thinking about now with your next book?
So let me just manage expectations. These are early days. You know, I'm a professor. It's going to take me a long time to finish the next book. And so the Spies, Lies, and Algorithms started off as a totally different book, and it took so long to write, the world changed. So that's probably going to happen with this book too. But the book I'm working on now is looking at how power is changing. So if we think about the conversation that most people are having today about international relations, they're focused on one power shift when actually there are three. The power shift we're all talking about is the rise of China. It's the competition between countries. But there are two other power shifts, and that's what this book is going to be about. The second power shift is the changing power dynamics within the United States. This is the relative decline of the federal government and its ability to conduct foreign policy. Think about the continuing resolution, how often we don't have a budget, how long it takes to get presidential appointments. By any metric, the basic functioning of our federal government to conduct foreign policy is declining, and declining precipitously from, you know, over time. At the same time, we see the rise of corporations and state governments as independent and powerful players in foreign policy. So Secretary of Commerce Gina Raimondo is spending, I would venture to guess, more time battling NVIDIA over its evasion of export controls as she is talking to Xi Jinping about what those export controls should be. Right. So the ability of the U.S. federal government to harness the levers of national power to make foreign policy is weaker now than it's been in a very long time. That's the second shift. The third shift, which to me is the most interesting, is the changing sources of national power. So historically, the sources of national power are things you can touch. They're tangible things like territory, ships, steel, populations that you can conscript or whose labor you can tax. Increasingly, the sources of national power are intangible things. Data, know-how in our heads, technology. Those intangible goods are much, much harder for states to leverage, to use, to harness, and control. So I think there are huge implications for everything from how we think about deterrence in a technological world to how we think about export controls, right? We can't export control our way out of this era or into solutions. And so that's the gist of the stuff that I'm working on now. It's a big, hairy project about power.
No, I love it. And what are we looking at, a year or two from now, or how long is this going to take?
Probably a couple years. Depends on how much other stuff I get myself into.
Well, that's true. And well, you have to, I think you can also kind of ride the Spies, Lies, and Algorithms book for quite some time. And it was, again, fantastic. And I would urge our listeners to certainly read it. And we'll have Amy back on again in the future. This is the point in the podcast where we have to say goodbye to our guests who are not yet subscribers. If you want to listen to the rest of this podcast and to all of the other shows in full, just go to the dsrnetwork.com and click on membership. It's only $7 a month, and it brings you a lot of great bonus content. So if you're not a subscriber, we hope you will be soon. And if you are one, stand by. We'll be right back.
Thank you for listening to Above Average Intelligence, hosted every week by Mark Polymeropoulos and David Rothkopf. Above Average Intelligence is a production of the DSR Network and was produced by Riley Fessler.